You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Laura Kipnis's previous books have been about love, scandal, and what she called the female thing. So I guess we should have known that sooner or later she was going to turn her attention and wit onto my sex, men, that is. And here it is, a book called Men, Notes from an Ongoing Investigation, which is published by Metropolitan Books. It's a collection of essays and musings with chapter titles like The Scumbag, The Con Man, The Trespasser, and Juicers, Gropers, and Cheaters. So I guess I'd better put on my seatbelt because this might not turn out to be an unbumpy ride, although there isn't a chapter called Radio Hosts, so maybe I'm okay. It is a pleasure to welcome Laura Kipnis to our show.
Hi, Leonard. Thank
you. Good to see you, I think.
I should say, though, that those titles are meant affectionately.
In fact, I was going to say the book takes a very compassionate view of men, including the juicers, the gropers, and so on. Did looking at these types of men, including a version of an old boyfriend in a novel written by Patricia Marks, another very funny woman, give you a new perspective?
I think what I realized looking back on these pieces that I'd written over 15 years or so was that I actually really identified with these men more than I wanted to be in a position of chastising them, but also I envied them. That was the great discovery that, you know, I envied, you know, even the forms of bad behavior because it represented a sort of freedom that I think I envy in, you know, in a larger sense, in an existential kind of sense.
Well, a lot of people, a lot of interviewers ask novelists, what was it like to write in first person for the opposite sex? And to some degree, it's also a way of understanding what other people are about. Was that process the same for you?
Yeah, and I think that as an essayist, I find that it is this, you have this ability to shift perspectives. I think a lot of essayists feel that what they're doing is writing from their perspective. And I find that I am unable to hold on to one perspective, and I'm constantly shifting around the room and looking from, you know, different points of view.
Although once in a while you're less kind, as in your chapter called A Critic about Dale Peck. Now, he has published a collection called Hatchet Jobs, so he's self-defining, isn't he?
That's true, but I thought there was so much aggression that played out in his criticism that it raised a lot of questions about the whole enterprise of criticism in general. So in all of these cases, I use these individuals as possibilities of saying larger things or making larger claims about dynamics, either between men or, and women, or in that case, you know, like, what is criticism about? And in his, he's such a great example of the psychodynamics of criticism because he really seems to be playing out these scenes from his own abusive childhood and enacting them on, you know, people who come under his scrutiny as a critic.
He once called a very respected writer the worst writer of his generation and got a lot of attention and a lot of abuse directed at him. But did you find him more thin-skinned than you might have expected?
After the piece came out, the first time I ran into him in a restaurant and he refused to shake my hand, I was introduced to him and I stuck out my hand and there it stood, there it was, hanging in the air as I broke out into a slight sweat. But yeah, I think that that is in general the case with aggression. And one of the things I was trying to get at in this book was that a lot of what we look at as the worst forms of male macho posturing actually does have a real core of vulnerability underneath, and we forget that part.
You've been quoted as saying that much of your career has been about redeeming culturally low things. I'm assuming that that led you inevitably to the topic of men?
That, and I had written early on an essay on Larry Flint, and it was I assigned myself the project of reading Hustler magazine, which I was very conflicted about and also completely disgusted by. But I ended up thinking that on many levels, politically, aesthetically, it was incredibly interesting. I mean, it was this use of pornography for political purposes aimed upward in this almost Rabelaisian kind of way. So rather than harp on the gender dynamics, I thought that there was much more vulnerability in those pages than anybody was recognizing, and also a kind of interesting form of class politics. So I think that did set me off on that path.
Class politics in that he was representing a kind of a lowbrow sensibility, but also in a very First Amendment way?
I was less interested in the First Amendment elements, which, like Milos Forman picked up in the biopic, The People versus Larry Flint, and I thought it was a much more radical piece of a magazine than that. I mean, if you look at typical men's magazines, they're always asking the men to identify upward, you know, with consumer durables and social power. And in Hustler, the men are much more wounded, vulnerable. They don't see themselves as winners in any sense in the social hierarchies, in the, you know, sexual caste system. So it's really about a kind of resentment as opposed to expression of power.
You say, in a way, you invented Flint.
I meant that. I was really being self-mocking there. I invented him in the sense that I fantasized a version of him. I wrote an essay about him. He ended up reading this essay. I was invited to meet him when I was in L.A. And then there I was sitting across the table from this actual, you know, very damaged, you know, flesh and blood creature. There was an assassination attempt 20 years before, and he's a paraplegic. And so I had invented this version of him, and then I was confronted with the real man. But he ended up using things that I had written about him in my essay, and or he or his ghostwriter put those phrases in his first person as his story of himself. So I was kind of flattered by that, but, you know, maybe a little appalled too.
What's your take on the explanation for pretty much every kind of male misbehavior is boys will be boys?
Well, the boys, you know, the juvenilia aspect of that is interesting to me. I mean, I have criticized all the rhetoric of maturity, like in Against Love, this whole idea that we all have to conform ourselves to mature love and give up, you know, things like lust and you know, playing around and, you know, another juvenile term. So I'm not, you know, when I hear words, terms like that used as a pejorative, my radar goes up. Like, why are we so invested in adulthood? What's so great about adulthood? And what are we being asked to renounce? So these forms of renunciation that are, you know, part of the fabric of everyday life, I'm kind of interested in. And I, you know, I'm not sure that we have a comparable phrase. Well, I guess there's bad girls now. You know, more and more women are occupying those badly behaved positions too, which I'm in favor of.
But it's also pointed out that whenever you're looking for perspective on your own life, whether you're male or female, or your relations with others, we're unreliable narrators.
That is a scary thing, isn't it? And I seem to be drawn to those examples. I'd written a book on Scandal, which had a lot to do with people in positions of power somehow organizing their own downfalls in public. So there is something about that fall from grace story that fascinates me, and I suppose in a worried sort of way, too. I'm, you know, always monitoring myself for the forms of self-deception I'm engaged in.
Now, the scandal led you, of course, to the Anthony Weiner story. Do you think that he consciously was trying to work out his own downfall?
It's something we seem to see more and more in the news, these stories of people who are you know, not in any way stupid people, doing something that seems incredibly, you know, at the least split. I mean, that term compartmentalization entered the vocabulary, I guess, when Bill Clinton was in office. And so, you know, we're actually watching and discussing, when we discuss these cases, you know, complicated theories about how consciousness is structured. You know, can you know something and not know it at the same time? Can you know that you're doing something that, you know, is career wrecking? I mean, the great example to my mind is John Edwards, who made these video webisodes, they were called, during his campaign, talking about his authenticity, that he wanted the country to know who he really was. And the person holding the video camera, taping him at the time, was this woman he was having this affair with. And you can still see that on, you know, the web.
On the other hand, there's a certain irony in the fact that many of the things he was talking about politically, about this being a country with two different populations, have been adopted by many of the Democrats. They just don't give him credit for
it. Yeah, he could have authored de Blasio's campaign. So he was prescient, I think, in terms of the direction of the party.
You say your father recognized him as a man in love immediately.
I was interested in that. My father's had his own interesting, you know, history. And I think it gives him insight, you know, more than I had at that moment. He looked at his expression, and I guess, you know, there was that kind of goofy expression Edwards had on his face, and my dad said he's in love. And it made me wonder about my dad's own experiences.
People often have wondered whether these people think they're so above the law that they'll never get caught. In the case of Anthony Weiner, what he did seemed so fourth grade, and if he had done it in the fourth grade, the principal would have called him in and said, girls don't like that sort of thing, don't do it anymore.
I really reject that hubris explanation, and I think we want to think that people do things like that in this fully conscious mode, and they're just, you know, assuming they won't get caught. And I think it's more complicated than that. We have this interest in seeing it as less complicated, because for one reason, it allows us to step back and mock those people. Whereas if you see it as this is endemic to human ways humans are constituted, this ability to be self-deceiving, it would make you worry a little more about your own position.
You've written several books about women, and those books are all written in a very disciplined, detached way. Is it fair to describe this book as a much more personal book, more personally revealing?
Yeah, I'm not sure I was being detached, and I think you're probably talking about the female thing.
Well, they're more typically essayistic.
Maybe so. I definitely wrote much more, well, I wrote in the first person in the men book. I kind of went back to these essays that I'd written over 15 years ago or so and put myself in the story more, which was fun. And I always thought of myself a bit as a critic in maybe more the Sontag mode, as, you know, an observer, didn't think of myself as a memoirist. So I think that maybe even Sontag now would be writing in the first person. So it seemed like a technique to try to experiment with.
People have said that these have been difficult times for males as a group. Hasn't there been a decrease in what we think of as typical men's jobs, the ones that involve physical labor, and an increase in the jobs that require more female-type skills, like sitting still and paying attention, jobs that could just as easily and maybe be filled better by women?
Well, I think men got killed in the last recession, and, you know, one of the sort of dirty little secrets about the women's rising pay rate as a proportion of men's is it's because men's wages dropped, that women's wages look like they're up. So, you know, I think one of my own regrets about the direction of American feminism is that it emphasized this whole idea of empowerment of women climbing the corporate ladder and taking over the boardrooms, and it kind of left behind these, you know, issues about employment and, pay all through the, labor hierarchy.
Your chapter on university sexual politics is not only provocative but quite hilarious.
Thank you.
What was your reaction to the incident that happened between Harold Bloom and Naomi Wolf when she was an undergraduate?
It was Naomi Wolf wrote an account of something that had happened 20 years before. Harold Bloom, the esteemed literary critic, had put his hand on her knee. She got up and ran to the sink and vomited. That's as she recounts it.
Happens when I put my hand on women's knees.
I'm sorry about that. It's, you know, 20 years later, she's saying she's still traumatized and could never write poetry again. She was doing a poetry independent study. And it just seemed a bit overblown to me. And I think, but more to the point, in episodes like this, we forget that the woman also has power in the situation, and she did have power in the situation. It wasn't a quid pro quo harassment. He was, he skulked off and licked his wounds in private.
Have you been following the story of the alleged rape at the University of Virginia? Because you've worked in universities, and you've also looked at university harassment guidelines.
Yeah, which are, I guess, in a way different things. I've been more interested in the faculty-student issues and the increasing regulation of those relationships. I mean, I, you know, somebody who thinks all fraternities and sororities should just be suspended indefinitely. Sorry.
There, any time you look at certain apps, some websites, there are always these stories about how female teachers slept with their younger students. I never see the opposite, or very rarely see the opposite in Huffington Post.
Oh, of men boasting about sleeping?
Well, it's a, you know, a woman, a teacher slept with her 17-year-old student. It seems to be one of the major topics of places like Huffington Post.
Oh, the scandals of the woman high school teacher who slept with the student. Well, it's so interesting the way the times have changed that way. I mean, at one point, I think, you know, 30, 40 years ago, that was seen as a rite of passage for guys, and that would have been considered getting lucky. And now we've redefined those kinds of episodes as traumatizing or, you know, that sort of thing, and, you know, and statutory rape.
What did you discover in your examination of men who hate Hillary Clinton?
I read through a number, maybe a dozen right-wing biographies by men written about Hillary, and the thing that I discovered was that they all focused on her physical appearance. I mean, in this microscopic ways, you know, this account of her thighs and her calves and her hairdos and her chins and her, you know, I mean, I made a joke, you'd fully expect to turn a page and find an accounting of her moles and what they indicated about her moral insufficiencies. These men are obsessed with her, but obsessed with her not in terms of her political policies, but her physicality.
And you're looking at books that were published by respectable publishers. You eliminated those books that were either self-published or included voodoo dolls.
There was a book called, yeah, something like Stick It to Her Before She Sticks It to You that came with its own Hillary voodoo doll. Yeah, I didn't read that one.
So have you come to any conclusions as a result of doing this investigation into men?
Men are really anxious these days. And, I mean, the Hillary biographers were a great example of that. I mean, I think with good reason. The balance of power between men and women in the world is shifting. I think men are under far more scrutiny at all levels. Women are less dependent on men financially and thus are more independent from them and critical. So, I think these are confusing times for everyone, but men and women both, particularly in the heterosexual sphere, and including for women who want to spend their lives with a man.
Laura Kipnis is a professor in the Department of Radio, TV, Film at Northwestern University, the author of How to Become a Scandal, Against Love and the Female Thing, and now Men, Notes from an Ongoing Investigation. It is published by Henry Holt, Metropolitan Books. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks, Leonard. This was fun.